Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Here then, I repeat and sum up. During the endless train journey which took me from Eisenach to Berlin, across the Thuringia and Saxony in ruins, I noticed for the first time in I don't know how long that man whom I call my double. To simplify matters, or else my twin, or again and less theatrically, the traveler.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today I thought we might have a discussion bringing together the seemingly disparate topics of familiarity, doppelgangers or doubles, Capgras syndrome, and social media. And I got the idea to talk about this today because a few weeks ago I read this interesting article that had a very intriguing central comparison or image. It was a thought-provoking essay by the Stanford neuroendocrinologist Robert Sapolsky. It was originally published a few years ago in Nautilus, and it was an article comparing the effects of social media and sort of the digital world like Facebook and, you know, all that to a psychological condition known as Capgras syndrome. And so today I thought maybe we should start by explaining and discussing Sapolsky's comparison and argument in that article and just see where we go from there.
Now, Capgras syndrome has definitely come up on the show before. I don't know that we've done a designated show on the topic, but it's certainly come up. But either way, we do need to, you know, provide a brief refresher on its history for our listeners.
Right. One of the important cases in which Sapolsky discusses in his article is the case of Madame M. This was a woman who lived in France in the early 20th century who had this persistent idea. She was fixated on the idea that her loved ones, including her husband, family members, people she knew, had been replaced by doubles or doppelgangers who looked exactly like them. So she would say, "My husband is not really my husband. He's a man who looks exactly like my husband used to, and I don't know what happened to my real husband." And this wasn't her only symptom. She had a number of symptoms. She believed that all kinds of things were happening to her children. I mean, it's a tragic story. But the underlying cause of what would lead someone to believe that people around them were being replaced by doppelgangers or doubles is interesting to consider. And so the way Sapolsky in this article characterizes the ultimate disconnect underlying Capgras syndrome is that when the module of the brain used in recognition of faces, specifically involving the fusiform gyrus in the brain, does cognitively recognize someone, but at the same time, the different module of the brain that normally responds to this recognition with the emotion that we call familiarity does not kick in. And this brain function responsible for generating the emotion of familiarity is what Sapolsky calls the extended face processing system. It's, quote, "a diffuse network including a variety of cortical and limbic regions." And apparently when we recognize someone, but we don't feel the necessary familiarity emotion that follows when we normally recognize somebody, what the brain often does when faced with this contradiction is to conclude that someone has been replaced by a double. It looks like them, but this person doesn't feel familiar to me. Thus, they must be a physically identical imposter.
In the past, I looked at a 2004 paper from the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry titled Capgras Syndrome, A Review of the Neurophysiological Correlates and Presenting Clinical Features in Cases Involving Physical Violence. And in this, they point out that the delusional identification syndrome generally involves right brain anomalies linked to a number of illnesses and neurological disorders ranging from schizoaffective disorder and Alzheimer's disease to severe head injuries, pituitary tumors, and migraines. Even alcoholism can play a role.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, each of us has a visual system and a limbic system, and the latter helps us to generate and process emotions. Damage or disrupt communication between these two systems, and suddenly a familiar face can inspire suspicion instead of comfort. Now, fortunately, Capgras syndrome usually subsides with the successful treatment of the underlying medical condition. You know, the tumor goes away, and thankfully, so does this suspicion that people are not what they seem to be. And in some cases, doctors can prescribe antipsychotic drugs to also achieve the same effect.
Mm-hmm. But you can easily see why the idea of someone being replaced by a double or a doppelganger would be such a captivating one. I mean, it's something that feels very perverted. You know, it plays on our great vulnerabilities, and I think it is not a coincidence that this kind of thing has featured into some of the horror folklore of the world. I mean, you think about the idea of the changeling,
right,
in fairy folklore, where there was this idea that where the fairy folk would come in and replace someone you knew, often a child, but sometimes like a husband or wife, or, you know, someone you knew with a fairy double who looked like them but wasn't familiar to you, didn't act like them. And now this is often described as something that people would use to explain, you know, maybe when somebody's behavior changed and they didn't seem themselves, they'd think, oh, maybe they've been replaced with a changeling.
Yeah.
Or used to explain why people might feel that their children weren't their own or something like that. But then also you have to wonder if some kinds of neurological issues may be at work here in the minds of the people making the accusation that someone is a fairy.
Yeah, and this obviously this idea in and of itself has played into so many myths throughout history, and also continues to just resound in our popular media. You know, this is a slightly older work, of course, but Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah,
I mean, that plays heavily on this trope, right? That people are being replaced by something else. People that we think we know are not actually those individuals anymore. It's been a huge. Yeah, you often find it also, you know, not only in speculative fiction, but in literary fiction as well. The quote that I read at the top of this episode is from a 2004 novel titled Repetition by one of my favorite French authors, Alain Robbe Grillet,
mm-hmm.
who often – this is a trope that he often threw into his books, like the idea of a double or some sort of an alter ego. And this book in particular, like, starts off with a character on a train having glimpsed his double once more.
Yeah, it's a very unsettling image.
Yeah, the plurality of self, right?
Well, and because it, so there are double ways that it can be unsettling. There's the idea that someone you know is replaced by a double. Obviously, if you were to come to believe that through, you know, whether you had like a brain injury or neurological condition that caused you to believe that, or I don't know if you just believed in fairies and thought maybe that this was happening because of your cultural conditioning. Either way, that would be a terrifying thing. It's another thing entirely to see, to believe that you see another version of yourself, you know, to think that you had your own double or there was a doppelganger of you.
So I think most of us are probably familiar with just the idea of a doppelganger. I would love to say that I learned about doppelgangers for the first time by either consulting a nice, you know, book on Germanic mythology. And certainly I read a lot of different mythology books when I was a kid. Also, I would love to say that my first encounter with doppelgangers was a Dungeons and Dragons monster manual. Because it's another huge place that they're highly visible, is they've long been a staple of Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, they're in there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a great way to introduce a little suspense and chaos into a campaign, right?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody, you know, an NPC that the characters trust has been replaced, or a doppelganger is trying to, or even successfully replaces a member of the party. So, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had with a doppelganger. But I have to admit that neither of these cases is true. I heard about them initially via the 1993 Drew Barrymore movie that aired on the Sci-Fi Channel. Back when, this is the old days, back when, before there were Wise in Sci-Fi.
Wise in Sci-Fi. Oh, Sci-Fi. You mean Sci-Fi.
Yeah.
Sci-Fi Channel.
Yes. I remember next to nothing about this film, but it was heavily promoted on the channel, and it introduced the idea to me initially, and then I, you know, followed up by, you know, asking around, hey, Dad, what's a doppelganger? And then I looked it up, et cetera.
Well, wait a minute. So it was called Doppelganger? That's the name of the movie?
That was at least, that was the title of the film as it was promoted on Sci-Fi Channel at the time. Though, of course, it's often the case with films of this caliber. They may have had multiple titles, and who knows, they may have been promoted elsewhere under a different title.
I just looked it up. It's also known as Doppelganger, : The Evil Within.
Ah, just to be clear, that was for the people who didn't know what a doppelganger was.
Always got to have a : real title.
So, but here's an interesting thing that I didn't realize until I was researching this episode. I just kind of assumed, you know, obviously the doppelganger itself, the term has Germanic origins.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured this is a creature that emerges from German folk traditions, you know. You know, in the same way that Krampus came down from the mountains and Alpine traditions. I just figured the doppelganger was just a standard. Because the idea of a mysterious double, either of self or other, is long established. But this does not seem to be the case. Apparently, the word doppelganger wasn't coined until the 18th century, and it was coined by German novelist Jean Paul in his 1796 novel Siebenkäse, in which the main character encounters his own doppelganger or double goer, and in this case, the doppelganger convinces him to fake his own death and start a new life.
Hmm.
And I had to look in closer on this. It's not as straightforward as I would like it to be, where he's just like, hey, this is the doppelganger. Apparently, he invents two similar words in this book. He invents the word doppelganger. So this would be the name for people who see themselves. But then he also talks about doppelganger as a word for the second course, when the second course of a meal arrives alongside the first course, because ganger means both, you know, goer, walker, as well as course in a meal.
Huh.
So technically, doppelganger would be the mysterious double idea that he introduces, and doppelganger itself is just a weird mishap of ordering a multi-course meal at a restaurant.
But nobody's going to say doppelganger.
No, not anymore. No, doppelganger. But this is a good idea. Next time someone introduces a doppelganger in your D&D campaign, remind the DM that's a culinary term, sort of. But anyway, the term ends up resonating in German literature, and it became popular in romantic horror literature in general by the mid-1800s.
So I think originally this idea was always something scary or dangerous, right?
Well, yeah, not as much seemingly in the original, and I didn't read the original German novel, just to stress. So, you know, feel free to correct me if anyone out there is more familiar with the literature we're talking about here. But It certainly took on sinister connotations within the literary tradition. But then I was reading about the term on Webster's, and the sinister connotations have apparently dropped off somewhat in its English language usage, which is surprising to me. But then again, I'm coming from the standpoint of knowing them mostly through Dungeons and Dragons and horrible Drew Barrymore movies. Mm-hmm. So I'm probably not like the key candidate here. I guess the other thing, too, is I really don't use the term outside of a fantasy context. Mm-hmm. Like, if I encounter someone who looks a lot like someone I know, I don't say, oh, hey, I saw your doppelganger today. I'm more like, hey, I saw your, maybe I'll say evil twin, which is, you know, another variation on this trope. Or I'll say, oh, I saw someone who looked just about like you. Or if I'm in another city, I might say, oh, I saw your Chicago you or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing. I just don't use doppelganger outside of fantastic settings myself.
I think most people just use it to mean a lookalike now.
Yeah, but I guess I don't even use it that way. Like, for me, if I think of doppelganger, I think of something like that creature in Kroll, which pretends to be the wizard, you know? I think something that when you reveal it, it's a horrible, pallid creature with jet black eyes. Mm-hmm. So if I'm not specifically talking about, like, a monstrous scenario, mm-hmm. I'm not going to use doppelganger.
Okay.
But that's just me. I also think that part of, but I think part of this whole idea of the sinister connotations fading away, it might have to do with the fact that if it is used by and large for just somebody's double, like if someone is to say, hey, I saw your doppelganger today at Shoney's, they're not going to, you know, there's not going to be a creepy connotation to that sighting. We're not going to say, oh my God, I saw your doppelganger at Shoney's and I was super creeped out. Mm-hmm. I think we need to call somebody. No, it's just going to be a point of whimsy. And the other thing is that more than likely, it was a first glance situation. Like at first glance, I thought it was you. At second glance, I saw that it was clearly another person and nothing to freak out about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would be shocked, though, if people didn't still interpret this kind of thing as some kind of weird omen or demon or whatever.
Oh, yeah. And I was glancing around on the internet, and there's still plenty of that. Mm-hmm. And I think a large part of that is, you know, as with all paranormal experiences or supernatural explanations for mundane encounters, the supernatural explanation is going to be more appealing. It's going, you know, it makes us feel more important. Mm-hmm. Like you want to feel like you're in a Alain Robbe Grillet novel and you saw your mysterious double and it, you know, reveals something about your, you know, your inner subconscious nature or something, or that you saw a ghost that looked like you. I mean, all these are far more interesting than, yeah, there are a whole bunch of people in the world and it was bound to happen sooner or later, but I saw somebody that kind of looked like me and had similar facial hair.
The way that you look isn't all that unique.
Yeah.
That's like the worst news of all.
Yeah, that's just nothing exciting about that, that story. You don't rush home to tell that to your significant other. But it does bring up the question, what are your chances of running into your own unrelated double, or for that matter, running into an unrelated double of someone you know? Well, according to anatomist Dr. Tegan Lucas, quoted in the BBC Future article, you are surprisingly likely to have a doppelganger, which I think is slightly confusing title given the contents of the article, but still, said that the chances of sharing just 8 dimensions with someone else are less than 1 in a trillion. And with 7.4 billion people on the planet, there was only a 1 in 135 chance that there's a single pair of true doppelgangers.
No, wait, what are these dimensions you're talking about?
Like 8 facial dimensions. Like if you take facial features and you divide them up into 8 dimensions and go to match those up.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, not like 8 spatial dimensions. I'm not sure how that would work.
Okay. Basically, the 8 sliders on your character creator for your face.
Right, yeah. Now, most of the time, though, again, we're not talking about exact doubles. You know, generally, these are just faces that are similar to our own or similar to someone we know, when we focus on the familiarity in a way that may be tied to a means of identifying close kin, in early human history. Like, that's what this recognition system is perhaps for. And, you know, think again about how generally doubles are kind of a first glance thing. The similarities may be jarring, but the differences will be pronounced as well. Now, the thing is, there are so many humans on the planet now, and we live in, closer confines in many situations. Seeing familiar features, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's any shared genetic heritage between two given individuals, right. You know?
Except in the sense that all humans share most of their DNA.
Yeah, in the grander scheme, yes. But yeah, if you're in another city, you see someone who looks kind of like you or looks kind of like a friend, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean they're your long lost cousin or they're a long lost cousin of your friend.
Right.
But it's a situation where we kind of broke the system through population growth and the birth of cities. And self-facial recognition and facial recognition abilities, they're also going to vary from person to person. So your doppelganger alarms just may not be as easy to set off as someone else's. So anyway, that's doppelgangers in a nutshell, both the origin of the term, but then a little bit about the science and the potentiality of seeing a double or near double somewhere in the world.
But thinking about what is at work with the erroneous detection of doubles in Capgras syndrome is, I guess, maybe what we should get back to when we come back after a break.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, we're back. And it's really us. We weren't replaced by strange creatures from the Monster Manual over the course of the advertisement. No, we're here. It's really us. And we're going to continue our exploration.
You know, I wanted to answer that with the Body Snatchers noise, but I don't know if I can make it exactly.
Oh, from the Donald Sutherland version?
Yeah, which is a great version, by the way.
I still haven't seen that. I've only seen the old black and white original.
Oh, the Donald Sutherland one is great. It's got Lambert from Alien.
Uh-huh.
It's got Jeff Goldblum. Mm. He's feisty. It's got, and it's got, from another sci-fi classic, it's got, what's his name? Who played Spock?
Hello, Leonard Nimoy.
Leonard Nimoy is fantastic in it. I think it's his great performance.
Well, that's a great cast. But the 1956 original, it had had Kevin McCarthy in the lead role.
Mm-hmm.
He was terrific. You also had Carolyn Jones, who would play Morticia on The Addams Family.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But also it was just black and white, and it really, at least the version I saw of it, like the darkness felt just so murky and dirty somehow. Like it was just a very nightmare-inducing film when I saw it as a kid.
Yeah, the paranoid visual vibe.
Yeah.
It's got a kind of a communist infiltration thing, doesn't
it? Oh, definitely, definitely. That's a very strong element of it, which just goes to show like the ideas of why this concept of doubles resonates so, because you can apply it to all these other scenarios, social and political.
Well, yeah, life. I mean, it's a common thing for people to say when they don't literally think that someone they know has been physically, bodily replaced by a you know, supernatural double. They might often think, I don't know this person anymore.
Right.
I mean, it's a similar, like, you know, they've been replaced with somebody replaced you with a different person.
Yeah, like, you just found out, you're getting to know them better.
Uh-huh.
You found out something about them you didn't know before, and now you think that they're like a different being entirely. And no, it's just because, you know, it turns out that they were maybe communist.
Or
like a different football team.
Well, to be fair also, it could be a case of, people overemphasizing dispositional traits, thinking that they should expect their loved ones to be incredibly consistent and trait predictable, when in fact people are inconsistent. It depends on the circumstances, how they behave. Maybe sometimes you are used to seeing someone only in one type of context, maybe used to only seeing them at work. And then when you see them in a different context, when you see them, you know, out with their friends or with their family, they seem like a totally different person to you. It can be jarring when you see those differences.
Oh, yeah.
And yet they're there for almost all of us. Almost none of us like really behave the same way in all contexts.
Well, let's talk about those contexts, especially the social contexts.
Yeah. So I want to come back to – so we've talked about doppelgangers a bit and the idea of doubles and familiarity and recognition. But I want to come back to that article I mentioned at the beginning where Robert Sapolsky makes this comparison between what is made clear about the brain basis of familiarity with Capgras syndrome and the ways that technology is changing our social relationships. So in Sapolsky's words, Capgras syndrome makes clear the brain basis for, quote, the differences between the thoughts that give rise to recognition. Remember, recognition is cognitive. You see somebody and you cognitively know who they are, and the feelings that give rise to familiarity. That's the emotion that says, yes, I know this person. They're different things. And Sapolsky's main point is, quote, these functional fault lines in the social brain, when coupled with advances in the online world, have given rise to the contemporary Facebook generation. They have made Capgras syndrome a window on our culture and minds today, where nothing is quite recognizable, but everything seems familiar. And I would actually go further than that and say I think that's an interesting point, but the inverse is true as well, that the online world creates these situations where you have familiarity without recognition and recognition without familiarity. So to further explore the point he makes a little bit. So he points out that, you know, essentially for all of our evolutionary history, our only social relationships have been face-to-face ones. And I'm struggling to think of a counterexample. I can't really think of a counterexample for relationships with real people. But for tens of thousands of years, of course, we have had language and we could have felt as if we had relationships with people we only heard about in stories, for example.
Now, obviously, we do eventually reach the point where we have the ability to engage in activities like having a pen pal,
mm-hmm.
and that may, you know, that's a case where you can have certainly a non face to face example. But prior to the advent of the necessary systems and technology, yeah, I struggle to think of an example as well. I mean, even sort of semi imagined situations such as speaking to the spirit of a dead ancestor or dead relative.
Right.
Like you're still depending upon a previous face-to-face relationship.
Yes. And even with pen pals, I mean, even the oldest versions of this, the non-digital communications, mm-hmm. just writing to people with letters, even if you've never met them before, that is anatomically recent. I mean, the vast majority of the time our species has been around, we didn't have writing. We couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
The only relationships we had were face-to-face relationships. And so it's entirely clear that our bodies and our brains have been shaped by an evolutionary niche in which all relationships were face-to-face ones.
Right. Even our history as a symbolic species mm-hmm. is mostly based on, almost exclusively based on face-to-face communication.
Yeah. And so when our only social relationships were face-to-face relationships, it was natural for facial recognition and familiarity at an in-person body-sensing level to be one of our main mediators of how we conceptualized, evaluated, and formed beliefs about our relationships. I mean, if you live in this non-technological world where your only relationships are face-to-face, it totally makes sense for you to use moment-to-moment, face-to-face, say, visual and touch data and things like that to get the best idea of what your relationships are and how you should feel about them.
Right. I mean, some of that goes back to the, we were discussing earlier about, kin identification, being able to tell, like, this is a relative. I can see it in their face.
Exactly. But, of course, there have been these technological changes that now allow relationships to exist and persist under circumstances other than face-to-face interaction. Of course, we already mentioned writing and literacy. Now, this allowed you to maybe send letters, though I'd say even for most of the time that's been around, that has been something that is limited to a small percent of humans, you know, because for most of human history, most people have not been literate.
That's true. And then of course, again, I feel like the pen pal, like the pen pal situation in which there is never a face-to-face meeting, like that's a slim slice of the overall pie. Most of the other written communications are going to be carried out with individuals in which there was at least a previous face-to-face communication.
Yeah. But then think about how hard this kind of thing can make relationships. I bet every single person listening has had the experience of relationship strife caused by a feeling, by a misunderstanding or some kind of feeling of emotional estrangement brought on by the media through which you communicate. A lot of us don't feel very comfortable talking to people on the phone. A lot of us don't, we have the experience of sending emails and being misunderstood, mm-hmm. having people not read your tone correctly or getting worried about the way somebody punctuated a sentence in an email. I mean, I bet you've had this experience.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think we all have, both in, personal contexts and work contexts. Hopefully, if you're dealing a lot via email with someone, you'll kind of get a feel for their tone and mm-hmm. how they tend to speak. But even then, there's so much room for miscommunication. Like even when you feel like you really are up to speed on how they present themselves in a textual manner.
Robert, if you don't mind me saying, you're kind of a terse emailer.
Am I?
I can see people getting worried when they get an email from you that maybe you're mad at them or something. Huh. I don't think that's necessarily always the case. Maybe sometimes you're mad at me. But I mean, I think you just tend to not spend a whole lot of time, worrying about how to phrase stuff on email. You just kind of bang it out and go, which I admire because, the amount of time that people waste trying to phrase stuff on email is a horror.
The thing is, I remember when I was younger, I would have these long email correspondences going on with friends mm-hmm. where we would respond sometimes sentence by sentence or at least paragraph by paragraph mm-hmm. where we'd respond to specific points and write at length in response. And at some point, this just faded away. I haven't really thought about it too much to try and figure out exactly like at what point, like which like technological or communications change altered that, or and or what life changes led to that occurring. But and at the same time, used to have long phone conversations with people, and now it's extremely rare for me to have a long phone conversation. It's basically like two people in the world that I have phone conversations with on a regular basis. One's my wife and one's my mother. And that's pretty much it.
Do you think maybe these changes have been brought on by other technological changes like the rise of social media?
I suspect they have, yeah. Like instead of having this longer, more thoughtful stream of communication with somebody that now lives in another city, you just have a continual trickle, So again, we just have that familiarity, like a trickle of familiarity going on instead of like an actual stream of communication.
Well, and it also, I think that the way that technology has changed our communication sometimes forces us to become a version of ourselves that we don't recognize. I mean, I was talking about how we write work emails. I actually don't love the way that I write work emails. I feel like often I have to I overuse like exclamation points and smiley faces and all that. And it's mainly just because I don't ever want to accidentally make somebody feel bad over email or make them get the wrong idea that I'm mad at them or something like that.
Double down on the emotional intention of the statement.
I hate it because I can feel myself feeling insipid and feeling not like myself as I type it. Mm-hmm. But I would rather feel like that than worry that I'm giving people the wrong idea or letting them think I'm mad at them or something like that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, but I totally understand it. Yeah. Sometimes you feel like you have to really make it clear. And I do find myself doing more and more of that with texts when I'm sending a text, you know, via my tiny pocket computer.
Oh, your pocket god?
Yes. Tiny pocket god. Yes.
Yeah. And so we've got obviously, you know, all the stuff we're talking about, email, phone, text messages and internet communications, the photograph in a way, kind of a modern communication method sort of.
Yeah. As it's become, you know, it's increasingly easy to take digital photographs and send them to other people. It becomes a form of communication, as does, you know, you mentioned emoticons as being like a way of tweaking textual content, but in many cases, like they're the prime language that is used in communicating, mm-hmm. To say nothing of memes.
Oh, I shudder at this thought. Memes are there's going to be a day in which the English language is replaced by memes. It's just like instead of an alphabet, you have a meme-a-bet, and you just like you paste the memes together to form ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I already feel, you know, and maybe this is just me feeling old, but I feel we've already reached the point where there'll be a thread about something, say on Reddit, mm-hmm. and there'll be a meme, and I have to research what the meme means. Like it's a new meme, and I have to figure out like where it came from, how it's used, and how it's potentially being misused, and how it's like evolving out of that misuse to understand like what the prevailing idea is that is being expressed.
Memes as a whole are exactly like words in the sense that you can try to write down a definition for a word, but word usage changes over time. I mean, words don't actually have fixed definitions. You can't control how people use them.
Yeah, kind of like the whole, like literally, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, sorry, you lost that battle. That word's changed. You can cling to the past, but sorry, it was just misused into a new usage.
Oh, I try not to correct people on that one, but that does, it still gets me. My blood was literally boiling and all that.
He literally took his head off, yes.
But yeah, so we're talking about the technological media on which our relationships happen. And I think many of our relationships, especially in the last, 10 years, now happen primarily on these media. And on one hand, that can be a good thing because it allows us to maintain relationships with people who we want to have relationships with but can't, you know, people we can't practically arrange to see in person as often as we'd like to. Several of my best friends live in different cities, mm-hmm. and we've been friends for years, and I'm only able to maintain friendships with them because of this technology. So I would hate to lose those friendships, but also I wonder about the fact that what is it doing to our culture when there's a substantial number of people who, like, I don't know, maybe 70% of their friendly social interactions happen over a machine?
Yeah. I mean, even people like flesh and blood friends that I have in the city with me, like we still have to do like a 30 email chain to plan to meet each other in real life. Mm-hmm. Like even if it's like a semi-regular thing, like we know where we're going to go. We know when we're going to do it, but we still have to coordinate all of these things. So how much of the relationship is truly face-to-face versus digital?
Yeah. And so Sapolsky says in his article that this technological reality has conditioned us in a way to dissociate our traditional pathways of recognition and familiarity. So he writes, quote, "Thus, not only has modern life increasingly dissociated recognition and familiarity, but it has impoverished the latter in the process." So impoverished familiarity. This is worsened by our frantic skill at multitasking, especially social multitasking. A recent Pew study reported that 89% of cell phone owners use their phones during the most recent social gathering. That sounds low to me. We reduce our social connotations to mere threads so that we can maintain as many of them as possible. This leaves us with signposts of familiarity that are frail remnants of the real thing. And I think he's really onto something there about the idea of maintaining, it's almost like putting up these scarecrows of things, like these technological stand-ins for relationships that are not really functioning biologically and psychologically for us the way relationships should, but we'd rather maintain as many of those as we can rather than have fewer relationships but more face-to-face interaction, you know, quality time and all that.
Yeah, so we end up maintaining these trickles of actual social connections as opposed to streams of social connection.
So he's saying there that we essentially degrade our sensitivity to the familiarity aspect of what knowing somebody is, a social interaction. It's recognition and familiarity. And when we degrade the familiarity thing, he says, quote, that we become increasingly vulnerable to imposters. Our social media lives are rife with simulations and simulations of reality. And so, of course, you know, that's, you know, one example there is people who claim to know you, but they're not. They're, you know, a friend's email account gets hacked. Some right. hacker contacts you and tries to get you to open some malware. That's one example. But there's a million versions of this thing where our sort of like low resolution familiarity detectors in this digital world are being exploited by people who are not actually our real friends.
So, I mean, basically, their online version of ourself is essentially a like you said, low resolution simulation. And so, if someone comes along to hijack that simulation, it's all the easier to do so. You don't have to be a high level magic user to take on the likeness of another individual when the threshold for duplication is so low.
Yeah. But then here's the turn. So Sapolsky says, by any logic, quote, this should induce us all to have Capgras delusions, to find it plausible that everyone we encounter is an imposter. After all, how can one's faith in the veracity of people not be shaken when you sent all that money to the guy who claimed he was from the IRS? Mm-hmm. And I think there is something going on here. It didn't start with this, but this imposter kind of thing, the doppelganger effect of the online world and the fact that it's easy to be tricked by an online doppelganger does help contribute, I think, to this concept. I'm sure you've encountered this, Robert, that the internet is not real life. People always say this, right?
Oh, you know, or it's like, they talk about somebody being a friend in real life.
In real life versus on the internet. But if most of your social interactions are happening on the internet, in what sense is that not real life? I mean, of course the internet is real life. It's like a technology. The stuff you're doing on it is actually happening. It's not like something that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. But you are making a distinction there. People in some way are seeing these interactions as derealized or as not having, you know, not material in the way that other interactions are. And yet they're where we're doing most increasingly all of our stuff.
Yeah. And I wonder if part of that, you know, I wonder how this plays out generation to generation. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like for me, I had a sense of the internet as being not real life more so early on because mm-hmm. the internet was in some respects like kind of an escape. I mean, mm-hmm. at the same time, yeah, I remember having to, you know, use a college email address and all that kind of stuff, you know. So you're still doing real life stuff via the internet.
Yeah.
But then a lot of other stuff is about escaping, either just in general, like escaping into fantasy, or like escaping geographical boundaries, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, being able to connect with people in other cities.
Well, I think there's another way in which there are multiple ways in which people came to see the internet as not real life, and one of them is anonymity. Mm. You know, that if you could go around invisible all day, what's that Harry Potter cloak that makes you invisible?
What was the title? I mean, it's in a cloak of invisibility, but I don't remember if it had any particular name.
Well, whatever that is, you could be invisible. In a way, that would feel not real, right? Because if nobody can see you and nobody knows who you are, wherever you are, then there are no consequences. And consequences are kind of what gives us the feeling of reality. So that's part of it. But I think also Sapolsky's onto something here in that, like, this estrangement of the sense of recognition and familiarity is it makes the internet start to feel like this world of social delusion, this sort of like always Capgras vulnerable type landscape where nothing is really real and you can't trust anything. And yet at the same time, we're constantly forced to put our trust in it as a matter of fact because that's where we're doing everything. But then, of course, back to the idea of like all these, you know, threads that people maintain and sort of mistake for meaningful relationships online, he comes back and on that and says, actually, you know, it seems more the opposite has happened than inducing us to all have Capgras delusions where we see people we knew and we think of them see people we know and we think of them as you know being a doppelganger or not familiar. Instead, we go the other way and we see people we don't really know very well, but we just have to attach this feeling of familiarity to them. It allows all of this false familiarity, and this really comes up in I don't know how have you read about the idea of you know parasocial interactions on social media?
You know, I don't think prior to this episode I knew it by that term. Mm-hmm. But of course, you do see it all the time.
Yeah, it's ubiquitous on the internet. It's the idea, you know, it's an asymmetrical relationship. The way like you follow a public figure who doesn't know who you are, but there are all of these indications that many people think of these parasocial asymmetrical relationships as relationships. It's like they almost view this Instagram influencer that they follow as like an acquaintance, somebody they know. But of course, that person doesn't know them.
Yeah, I really started thinking about this classification, though, of parasocial relationships and wondering, like, to what extent it can or could have existed in previous times. Like, what is the earliest possible example of a parasocial relationship? Like, maybe it could be a situation where you have, like, a leader in a given community, and then you have like a very low level person in that community that the tribal leader just has no real idea of who they are.
Yeah.
But of course, you know who the leader is.
Right.
I mean, I guess that's sort of the in real life version of this. But we see it. It seems like we see far more of it in modern civilization, certainly in the internet age, but even pre-internet, like the idea of celebrity just enables this sort of relationship to be possible. Celebrities and leaders.
And of course, I would say that social media, of course, did not invent the idea of celebrities.
No.
So it didn't invent these relationships like you're talking about. You know, you've always had leaders, you've always had public figures in some way or another. Social media, I think, has increased the day-to-day relevance of these types of relationships, you know, where you can like check in on the accounts of the people that you follow every day and they don't know you. But, you know, you especially – I feel like Instagram especially of all the platforms I can think of is really rife with this of like these influencers and people who lead kind of glamorous lives and allow you to see into their lives by showing you their – house and their pets and their lunch, and you know, you get all these interior views, and it's very visceral because it's visual and often, you know, visual even in a way that's edited to make it more colorful and exciting with the post-processing filters and all that.
Right. And of course, at the same time, like all social media representations like this, they are they're incomplete.
They're
maintained in a very strategic way usually, so you don't even have like a full vision of what, you know, random celebrity's life actually is. You just have this idealized version of it.
So I just want to read one last quote from Sapolsky's article before we move on. So he says, he ends by saying, quote, "Throughout history, Capgras syndrome has been a cultural mirror of a dissociative mind where thoughts of recognition and feelings of intimacy have been sundered. It's still that mirror. Today, we think that what is false and artificial in the world around us is substantive and meaningful. It's not that loved ones and friends are mistaken for simulations, but that simulations are mistaken for them." I think I kind of disagree with him a little bit because I think it's actually both of those things. It's like that the dissociation goes two ways.
In either case, though, we often find ourselves in situations, though, where we are distracted from real life relationships and real life socialization, and instead we have to check in on these little streams on our phone to just to these the simulated relationships that we have on social media.
Do you ever have the sort of direct doppelganger experience, like with the fairy changelings or the doppelganger, for a friend on the internet? Like, you have a family member, you have a friend who you love in real life, but when you see the way they are on the internet, I don't know what it, you know, the kind of stuff they post on social media or mm-hmm. whatever, you don't feel like you recognize them and you don't really like them. I've definitely known people who are like that. I'm not going to name any names, but who are like that on, say, Twitter. Like, I think, like, I love this person, but if all I knew about them was the way they act on Twitter, I wouldn't be able to stand them.
Well, social media, especially as it pertains to, you know, some topics, take politics, for instance, mm-hmm. I think it does tend to bring out the worst in us. And I don't think that is a risky comment to make. I think we can all think to specific examples of that in all of our own lives. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that can lead you to a situation where you're like, well, I thought I knew that person, but I guess I don't, because look at this meme they just shared.
Right.
You know?
But I think also, though, when that happens, we're just not appropriately appreciating the way that circumstances and situations change people's behavior, mm-hmm. that we're the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
All right, we're back. I was thinking about what you said about my emails. Yeah. But I feel like 60, maybe 75% of my emails are me just saying, cool, sounds good. I think that's my standard, yep. Which I feel is sufficient. It's just me saying yes to whatever you just said, and I'm cool with it.
Do you have an Android phone?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. You use Gmail? Yeah, you use Gmail.
Yeah, but I don't use I know you have the sort of, you know, the auto language feature.
Starts telling you what to say. It's like, here's the email you could write. Man, when I saw that thing, I was like, get out. What the heck? No, no, no.
Well, it's an easy jump to go from there to like authorized simulations of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, to just, which I mean, that's not far off. It's basically already here, where you just give your account the authority to make responses like this, like, cool, sounds good, I'll get back to you, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, it's not going to – I don't know. I mean, even if I would type exactly the words it's suggesting, I still don't want to let it do that. The fact that, like, Gmail is going to compose an email for me to my parents or my wife, no, unacceptable.
There's so much room for misunderstanding, even if we're applying – most or all of our attention to crafting an email. It feels like a machine, even a very like talented AI would have difficulty with that. There's just so much nuance in human communication and knowing who you're communicating to. Like sometimes it's a matter of knowing there are certain words you shouldn't use with another individual. Like maybe you're aware of what, you know, maybe, you know, some sort of a trigger for them or, you know, it may pertain to some sort of, incident from your personal past with that person. Like there's so many potential holes to fall into when composing written communication. Why trust that to the machine? Or I don't know, maybe the reverse is true. Always trust it to the machine as long as they have all those caveats in mind.
You know, I think one thing that's interesting to me is about the psychological effects of heavy social media use. I feel like we're still in the early days of getting a picture of what that's like and that there appears to be a lot of conflicting evidence. I think because we haven't refined all our categories and ways of testing things yet. I do often say that I think in emerging, this is just a prediction. I could turn out to be totally wrong, but my guess is that in the coming years, there's going to be emerging consensus that heavy social media use, especially say among young people like teenagers and stuff, is correlated with a lot of negative psychological outcomes and depression and things like that, and that there will be like a new cottage industry of like the lobbyists who deny the emerging science on social media. But I mean, I guess that's still to be seen. I mean, we've only got a few years of data to work with so far.
Yeah, when trying to imagine the future, it's difficult and also, you know, kind of, you know, anxiety inducing to try and think about where our social media usage is going. On one hand, I guess I'm hopeful that more and more people will, you know, choose to, if not opt out of social media, at least rethink how they're using it, step back from it even. Mm. I kind of think of it, it's kind of like a hot tub. You know, when you first get into a hot tub, you're just all in. You know, it's like, let me just go all the way up to my ears in this and I'll zone out. And, you know, that's good for a while. But then eventually you realize if I stay in here, I'm going to die. So maybe I need to like only put half of my body in here. Maybe I should just sit on the side and dip my feet in here. Or maybe better yet, maybe I should go get in the pool for a while and do that. Or even maybe I should leave altogether and go home and see my family.
Yeah.
That sort of thing, you know?
It is nice at first. I remember thinking about when I very first got on Twitter, it seemed like it was nice for a while. That I was mostly just seeing things that learning and things that people were enthusiastic about. People were sharing their enthusiasms. Here's a great thing. Mm-hmm. And over time, I'm not sure exactly what happened, but it seemed like it transformed into more like this swamp of misery where the primary emotions coming off of it was just that everybody hates everything.
Of course, all of this, of course, is dependent on how exactly one uses a social media platform, mm-hmm. who you follow. Like, for instance, like on Instagram, obviously there's a lot of celebrity worship going on, a lot of parasocial relationships taking place there, as we already mentioned. I don't see as much of that, and part of that is just because I like only follow family and friends, and I only use it myself for family photos, and it's like it's a closed account.
Well, I do think that there is some evidence I've seen so far that, and I'm not sure how solid this is yet, but there's some evidence that there's a pretty big difference in the psychological effects of social media depending on whether you primarily use it as a way of keeping up with family and friends versus as a way of interacting with public accounts.
Right. But I think – but then again, one of the dangers in all of this is even if there is a preferred – if there is a healthier way to use a given platform, you are still fighting against the intended usage of that platform as engineered by the makers of that platform.
The intended usage of the platform is to open it up and never get off.
Exactly.
And keep,
yeah. It's,
just
And so, like, it's difficult to compete with that. I mean, we've talked about this on the show before in terms of gambling technology and then social media technology. I mean, you're really up against a fearsome adversary in telling yourself, I'm only going to use this in a way that is mentally beneficial for me and not just purely economically beneficial for the masters of the medium.
You know, Jaron Lanier, who we've talked about on the show before, has written a book about it, basically it's saying everybody should delete their social media accounts, just get off these platforms, and that will be – it will make a much better world. And he's got a whole argument for it in this book, which I haven't read yet, but I – plan to. In fact, we asked for some review copies, but I think we should see if we can try to get Jaron Lanier on the podcast.
Oh, yes. I think we should.
I also wonder what he would think about this comparison. I still feel like there's a lot of stuff to work out, but I sense that Sapolsky's comparison here about the rift between the emotion of familiarity and the cognitive recognition function of the brain that's at work in Capgras syndrome, this is a really rich kind of comparison for social media and media technology generally, and I expect to keep having more thoughts about it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to just sound like I'm just saying like the people are awful and that technology makes us more awful. You know, I don't want that to be my ultimate argument. I mean, ultimately, I would say that technology enables humans to do amazing things. And if we direct this power in the right way, you know, there's plenty that we can do. There's plenty we have done to connect people and build a better world out of those connections. But obviously there's more that we could do. And I guess the worrisome thing with these platforms, the various platforms that we're talking about, is like, what is the ultimate advantage? What is the ultimate intention of the masters of those given platforms?
Yeah.
What do they want? And even in cases where they may say, no, we want to build something that brings people together. We want to build something that empowers, you know, a better world. Like, is that impulse going to win out in the overall structure of this given social media platform, or is it going to be profitability or engagement or some other metric that is ultimately more important to the corporate entity?
It's always profitability. I mean, of course, that's always what's going to win out.
But I feel like there's I have to hold on to the possibility that humans can do better, though. You know?
Well, I mean, that does make me wonder if perhaps what you could do instead is have some kind of nonprofit open source social media platform that would compete and try to replace these for-profit forms that are deranging our relationships and causing this familiarity recognition rift and potentially having all these psychologically negative consequences on our lives and on our culture broadly. I'm not sure exactly what that would look like. I mean, it would probably be a start if there was just something that was like Facebook, but that did not manipulate what people saw and prioritize, you know, conflict and paid content. But then again, even just with the, you know, the bare bones basics of Facebook, I wonder about, you know, having these friend networks. Does the even the most basic mechanic of something like Facebook encourage people to go through these mental processes where they sort of degrade their standards of what counts as a healthy relationship?
I mean, maybe ultimately that's where AI can come in, you know? And we need artificial intelligence to dictate where and how to maintain healthy relationships online. Maybe that's the ultimate answer. I don't know. Just hand it off to an AI deity to manage.
Well, I'm not hopeful about that either. Again, this is back to like I'm worried about these little AI squirrels. I'm not worried about the great basilisk. I'm worried about the minor dumb AIs that are running through our lives like a pest infestation.
Now, you know, not to end things in too negative a place, I do want to refer listeners back to our The Great Eyeball Wars.
Oh, yeah.
Where we went into a lot of this, particularly about, you know, about how social media and these platforms and our phones are gamed to capture our attention and hold our attention. In those episodes, we also shared some advice that experts have given about how to fight back, how to limit your use of social media and or your phone.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there are increasingly more tools out there. I believe, you know, some of these phones have ways, you know, now to track how much you're using them, or even to remind you not to use them in certain situations.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can't honestly and non-hypocritically tell people to get entirely off of social media, because one of the things is I have to maintain social media accounts because of my job at this podcast, where we've got to like promote stuff on social media. And, you know, we've got a Facebook discussion module that I really enjoy using. I probably would have deleted my Facebook account, but I enjoy our discussion module with our fans there.
Yeah, yeah, it's probably one of the main reasons I go on Facebook these days. So, discussion module, don't screw this up. Let's keep this positive relationship.
But I mean, I will say that the reason it's on there is not any inherent strength of Facebook. It's on there because of audience inertia. I mean, that's where the people are.
Right.
Like, if you want to have a place where people already have accounts and they can join, Facebook is, they tell us, the place where you can do that. You know, I'd love a world where somebody created some kind of non-destructive, open source, nonprofit platform where you could do a similar thing if enough people could get on there.
All right. So there you have it. Obviously, there's a lot of areas here we can call out to listeners on. I mean, first of all, have you ever encountered a really impressive double in your life? Like someone that required, not even just a first and second glance, but maybe a third glance to realize that they were not your friend or perhaps not yourself. Mm-hmm. We'd love to hear from that. If you've actually had any experience with Capgras syndrome, we would really appreciate any firsthand knowledge of experiences like that. And then beyond that, when we get into the literary and the fictional and the mythological connotations, if you have a particular favorite double you want to share. But certainly, we spent most of the time here talking about this social media doppelganger idea. And so, I mean, you're pretty much all on social media at this point. Well, really, you're either on social media or you've made a very firm choice not to be. So whichever category you fall into, I feel like you probably have thoughts related to this episode, and we'd love to hear from you.
Absolutely. Get in touch.
In the meantime, if you want to listen to more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes. You'll find a link there to our little merchandise store where you can get some squirrel shirts. It's a fun way to support the show. But the best way to support the show is to simply rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. If you can leave some stars, leave a nice review, do that. And best of all, tell somebody about the show. Yeah, tell them online. But even better, if you see somebody in real life, tell them about the show in real life.
Wow.
Because I feel like, it's gonna impress people all the more.
That's right. Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly, sorry, I'm laughing because Robert has got a little stress ball over here and he's squishing the guts out of it as we speak.
Yeah, there's like some sort of white pus coming out of it. I had it for like 2 weeks and it's already squeezed out. So I'm not going to name the brand because maybe I just have a defective one.
Anyway, sorry. If you want to get in touch with us directly, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.